Hi, podcasters. This is Brooke with Let's Talk Art. Today I'm talking art with New York author, film critic, and writer Brian Scott Mendick again. I always love to hear what he's been up to. He's a New Yorker, so I get all the dirt on the Broadway shows and find out about books I want to read. He's been up to a lot since we last spoke. We talk about Billy Crystal's Mr. Saturday Night on Broadway, Paul Newman's posthumous memoir, what? Mel Brooks' memoir, and a lot more. Enjoy!
I've never been smart with investments or stocks, but one thing I've learned over the years is that an investment in knowledge pays the best interest. If you want to get smart with your money, you can trade smarter and maximize your returns with Trade with UFOs. Trade with UFOs is the brand that represents the community of users trading with predictive tools. You don't have to be good with stocks. They literally hold your hand while you trade, teaching you everything you need to know. You see, Trade with UFOs is also a portal which provides access to predictive apps, predictive courses, and predictive coaching, all to show you how to make money using unfilled orders. Why am I so passionate about this? Because then we'll all have money in our pockets to buy more art. It's time to get smart with your money. Leverage your success with Trade with UFOs. Go to tradewithufos.com and use my offer code Brooke for a 50% off discount on all their products. 50%! Oh my gosh!
Hi, Brooke.
Hey, Brian. How you doing?
Good. How are you?
Doing good. How was your day?
Pretty good. How about you?
It was okay. It's not bad. I think my boyfriend and I are both getting over. I'm not quite over my. I've got like a bug, but yeah, it's going okay.
Good.
So what have you been up to? We haven't talked in a long time.
Yeah, it's been a little while. Just been working on stuff as far as writing, updating my website. I wrote an essay for the Library of Congress's National Film Registry a year ago, about broadcast news, which is one of my favorite films of the 1980s with the amazing cast, William Hurt and Albert Brooks, Holly Hunter. Written and directed by one of my favorite directors, James L. Brooks, and it was put on the National Film Registry in 2018. So this was actually the fifth essay I wrote for them. The others were Tootsie and three Gene Wilder films. So it was a lot of fun working on it and revisiting a film that I have such fond memories of. I first saw it when I was 14,
right,
and which is a little young to kind of appreciate the intricacies of a movie like that. But right. I loved it the first time I saw it. And my mother took me to see it, and then I wanted to see it again. I was in a habit back then. Well, this was, you'd have to wait like almost a year for things to come on video, So
yeah.
Yeah. So,
I remember that.
Yeah. So, I would like to see movies again in the theater. And, my mother was like, no, I don't want to see it again. She said to my father, you take them. So I remember 1987 being a particularly great year for films. Mm-hmm. Moonstruck came out that year, which is one of my very favorite films.
Yeah.
And you had Fatal Attraction. You had The Untouchables. A lot of really, really great films. Radio Days, one of Woody Allen's best films. So it was really a great period to go to the movies, and this is one of the films that stood out to me because it was just so witty, so smart, and it made a statement about style over substance. It was set in the world of television news, but that was basically a metaphor. Could have been set in any environment because these characters were so unique and so vulnerable. And, it was an incredibly well-crafted script and a really great film.
Awesome. Awesome. I never saw it, but it's now I want to see it because it does sound really good.
You definitely have to see it. It's a great film.
Yeah. Who's in it?
You have William Hurt. Albert Brooks, who I think gives his very best performance, and that's saying a lot. And Holly Hunter, this was the film that really made her a star.
Okay.
She had uh, She'd only been in Raising Arizona before this, but this is the film that just won her raves and her first Oscar nomination. And it was up for a lot of Oscars actually that year. And Albert Brooks was nominated, but he was nominated for supporting, which he was clearly one of the three leads. They nominated William Hurt for lead, but it was one of those cases where they knew Albert Brooks. I don't know if it's because he was a comedian as well as an actor, that they would not nominate him for lead. So they pushed him for supporting and he got the nomination.
Okay.
Which the Academy is pretty notorious with doing. I've had this conversation recently with some people about how people get nominated in the wrong category. In fact, even this year, there was controversy with Michelle Williams being pushed for Best Actress for The Fabelmans, and she was nominated. But most people said it was a supporting role. I haven't seen the film yet, so I can't comment, but... they do it all the time. I think Anthony Hopkins in Silence of the Lambs, he had, I think, one of the least amount of screen time for a leading actor winner.
Main character.
He was really a supporting player, but they pushed him as one of the as a lead, and he won. And it's unfair because, you know, when you nominate someone in their own category, then you're leaving someone else out who's legitimately should be in that category.
Right.
So. But, it's just, you know.
I don't normally know a whole lot about movies, but I am going to push back a little bit on this one because I did see Silence of the Lambs, and I think that even though you're right, he probably did have less acting time than a lot of the other people, but I think he was like a main character because I think without him, I don't think the story could have gone anywhere.
I agree. I think that's a credit to how good Anthony Hopkins is, that even though he had such a small amount of screen time for a lead actor, he made such an impression. And I think that's why the Academy voters voted for him in that category. But also you have to remember, they do ad campaigns. The studio pushes them for a certain award. So if they hype them for lead actor, that's what they're going to, I mean, they can vote however they want, but they typically vote along the lines of what the studio wants to put them in. And that's what happened this year with Michelle Williams. They pushed her for lead, even though she's been considered by many critics and pundits to be supporting. So that's what the Academy voters, they chose to put her in the lead category. So it happens all the time. It's nothing new.
Right. That's interesting. I never would have imagined that. But that's interesting. You say it happens all the time. That's wow. So how do you actually find these opportunities, like to write for the Library of Congress and stuff like that?
In that case, I just asked them.
Okay. that's one way to do it.
Yeah, because the first one I wrote for them was. I'm trying to think if it was the producers. Now I'm trying to think which one it was, but I saw they had a list of essays and I just contacted them and said, you know, hey, I'm Gene Wilder's biographer. Would you, have any interest in me writing an essay about this movie? And they said, yeah, sure. And it's more of a prestige thing because it's the Library of Congress. And also if you look at the essays, not every film that's on the registry has an essay, but if you look at them, some of them are by very distinguished and respected film critics and film historians. So it's nice that to just be in that company of people who are writing these essays.
Right.
And the first one was actually on Young Frankenstein. Okay. Then I just contacted them again, and Broadcast News was my fifth one for them. So they're a lot of fun to write. They're very loose in terms of there's really no deadline.
Yeah.
So you kind of create your own deadline.
Yeah.
And each one you write, it's a chance to revisit the film and rewatch clips and really go in depth and perhaps pontificate a bit and about why the film is so esteemed and the cultural and significant value, which is basically what the criteria is for making the list of the National Film Registry. So it's, you know, it's one of those writing projects. It's a lot of fun, even though you don't get paid for it.
Yeah, that was going to be my next question. Do they pay you for it?
No, it's the government. The government likes to take money, not give money.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. This was kind of what I was assuming.
Yeah, having just filed my taxes, I can testify to that.
But it is prestigious, and you can, like, I can imagine how that would be.
It's a nice thing to put on the website. It's a nice, you know, it's a nice credit. And again, it's a nice company to be in with these other writers.
Right. And do they, like, would they, like, and you said that they don't have any criteria, but, like, would they ever, like, turn you down? If you asked.
I don't know. There was a different person there when I wrote the broadcast news piece, and she was very nice and very helpful. And there was someone else who was there before that. And I think maybe she got tired of me. I was only contacting her like every year and a half or so. I wasn't pestering her, you know, and she agreed for me to write. She agreed for me to write four of them. So, and then I didn't hear anything when I pitched a few others. So I don't know, but there's a new person there, so I don't know.
Well, I found personally that the best way to get things done is to make a nuisance of myself. So.
Well, that's one way also. Yeah, it's like when I got some of these celebrity interviews, you know, people said, "Well, how'd you get them to talk to you?" I said, "I just contacted them and I asked."
Yeah.
And the worst thing is you get no response, right, which is exactly. Very often the case, or you get a no, which is sometimes the case.
Yeah.
But once in a while, you get a nice surprise and they say, yeah, sure, I'll talk to you.
Absolutely. Absolutely. No harm in trying, for sure.
Exactly.
Yeah. So what about Billy Crystal's Mr. Saturday Night on Broadway?
Yeah, so that was one of the prestige shows of last year when it opened in the spring. And I'm a huge Billy Crystal fan. I've always admired everything he's done. And I missed him when he was on Broadway twice, actually, with his one-man show, 700 Sundays. And I have very mixed feelings about Broadway, because when I was in my, I would say in my late teens and in my, like, well into my 20s, late 20s, I would go to Broadway shows, I wouldn't say a lot, but when there was something big, an event kind of show, like Jerry Lewis coming to Broadway in Damn Yankees, or Nathan Lane and A Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Forum. You know, these are like, oh, I can't miss this. I got to see this. And top ticket prices used to be, you know, now they'd be considered, you know, ridiculously cheap. You could get an orchestra seat, center orchestra, first few rows for under $100.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Now I think, at intermission, a beer is $100. So,
wow.
It's just ridiculous how expensive it got. If you want a good center orchestra seat, it's over $300.
Wow!
And I rarely find it obnoxious, because the average New Yorker cannot go see a Broadway show.
Right.
I don't know how the average tourist can go see a Broadway show.
Right.
Especially, let's say you're a family of four. That's $1,200 you're spending just to see a show.
Right.
And that doesn't include
paying all the money to get to New York.
Right. You know, so I don't even see how tourists are doing it. So it's kind of made Broadway into something that only the very wealthy can afford. And, you know, I think the arts should be for everybody. Everyone should have access to the arts. And that being said, I caved in and I bought one of those ridiculously priced orchestra seats. And I said, look, I haven't been to Broadway in actually several years. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm going to do it. And this way, I'm thrilled that I did, because it was such a great experience.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a great show per se. And mm-hmm. I say that because as a musical, there are not a single one of the musical numbers to me was memorable or had the potential of being a classic. I think, though, as a show, Billy Crystal is just so naturally funny, and the rest of the cast.
Yeah.
David Paymer, who played his brother in the movie, played his brother on stage, and they were all just so terrific. The musical numbers, though, it seemed like, okay, let's stop. Now let's sing. Now let's go back to talking. The parts where they were just doing the straight play part of it, the book, was just absolutely hysterical. But it was very well done. And it's one of these shows, it can't be in regional theater or anything because it relies on Billy Crystal. Only Billy Crystal can play this part. It's basically the Billy Crystal show.
Right.
And that's not to denigrate it in any way. It was a great experience. It was just absolutely just thrilling 2.5 hours, whatever it was. And Billy Crystal at 74, 75, however old he is, a lot of energy. I mean, to do a show like that, he wasn't doing the usual 8 shows a week, but he was doing close to it. He was doing 7 shows a week. And that's a lot for anybody of any age.
Yeah.
And he has it. I mean, he is just absolutely terrific. And everyone, there were these, you know, some actors who are not household names. They were terrific. So it was just incredibly well done. And I'm glad I saw it. But I think it's going to be a while before I plunk down over $300 to see see another show. Trying to think who could come to Broadway that, you know, would be worth that price. A friend of mine said, well, he's not Barbra Streisand. And I said, I consider him on the same level as Barbra Streisand. My friend disagreed, but this is a friend who paid over $300 to see Barbra Streisand.
Different audience, I guess.
Yeah.
But
although I went to see Barbra Streisand twice, and boy, what, you know, that's one of those things, you know, I'm glad I did. She puts on an amazing show.
Yeah. Well, I was curious, like, Billy Crystal is usually considered a movie actor, so this is like kind of a switch for him. So do you think that has he always been doing Broadway, or is this just kind of like...
No. He did Broadway with his one-man show, which was sometime in the 2000s, and it was a big hit. He won a special Tony for it. Then a few years later, he came back and revived it. But Billy Crystal started out, you know, started out as stand-up, and then on television, he made an appearance on the first season of Saturday Night Live, and then he was on Soap as a regular, and that really made him famous. And then he had a great run on Saturday Night Live in 1984 doing the Fernando character and Sammy Davis Jr. And then he just started doing one movie after another, and he was just he's one of those naturally funny people.
Right. But I just think I love that when you take a comedian and put him in, I don't know. I just think that's put him in like a stage role. I think that's just, it's like almost juxtaposition, but it's not. I don't know. I just love it though. It just makes you stop and be like, whoa, what?
Well, a lot of great comedians don't get enough credit for their acting. Mm-hmm. I remember seeing, talk about something that, you know, a great experience. This was years ago. Joan Rivers did a Broadway show about Lenny Bruce's mother. Mm-hmm. And she was absolutely phenomenal. She was nominated for a Tony, totally worthy of it. Joan Rivers was a good actress, mm-hmm. But she really never got a chance to do much acting. She was so well known for her stand-up and for being her, mm-hmm. but she was able to carry a whole Broadway show.
Yeah. Wow.
So she's another person who's up there, and just another, you know, another class, you know, just, you know, there's Joan Rivers and then it's like everyone else.
Wow. That's wild. And like, you mentioned Barbra Streisand, and like, I never like would have, I mean, I honestly don't know a whole lot about Barbra Streisand. I like what I've seen her in. I think she's a fine person, but I don't think she's like amazing. But she doesn't disappoint. I mean, she clearly has her fan base, and she's how do you think you can get that way? Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, I understand what you're saying. My whole thing with Barbra Streisand is she's one of those rare people who can do everything, mm-hmm. and she doesn't do one thing well. She does everything, mm-hmm. she does, mm-hmm. amazingly well.
Yeah.
Terrific, great. She can direct, she produces, she acts, she sings, she is just incredibly talented. Mm-hmm. And she wasn't one of these people who had to struggle for years and years to be successful. Mm-hmm. She was successful by 21 years old. Wow. So yeah, so she was just incredibly, and she still is, very, very determined. She's mm-hmm. tough. And she knows what she's doing. I mean, she's just very, very good. And, you know, she's just, you know, a legend. You know, I mean, we have, legend is a word that's freely used these days. I don't think we have many living legends left mm-hmm. who are, you know, have the capacity to perform and put on a 2-hour show in a big stadium. Billy Joel does it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I've never seen him in concert, but he's at Madison Square Garden regularly. He's in residence there. Mm-hmm. And to me, he's one of the greats in music. So these people are very, they have a drive that the average person doesn't have.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, you know, I think they're just, and also look, luck plays a hand also.
Right.
Paul Newman said, you know, and Woody Allen said this, a lot of the big ones, they said, you know what, I got very lucky.
Yeah, yeah.
And lucky, because I've known some amazingly talented people who never made it far.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you had mentioned that, like, she didn't struggle. She found that she was very lucky. She found the success. Well, but how did that happen?
She started out in the village here in Manhattan, and performing small clubs with, ironically, some of the people I already mentioned who were not known then either: Joan Rivers and Woody Allen and Dick Cavett, Bill Cosby, and they were all performing in these small clubs. Mm-hmm. And then when she was 21, she got her first Broadway part, mm-hmm. and she was on all the talk shows, she was on the Tonight Show, and she just, you know, and then it, she just really sealed the deal when she did Funny Girl, both the show and the movie. Right. And she won an Oscar for her first movie.
Wow. Wow. That's amazing. That is amazing. If only we could all have her luck.
Really? I tell you, if only we could have her house.
Yeah, absolutely. But I mean, and there's something that I found about luck, and there's a saying, and it's a cliche, but luck has to find you working, which is absolutely, I'm just more and mm-hmm. more finding that true. I mean, you have to, like, be putting yourself in the right places to
sure. get
that luck. So, I mean, it's not all just luck isn't finding you,
Yeah. You also try to make your own opportunities, and right. you know, as you get older, you look back and say, oh, you know, I should have done that. I shouldn't. But then it's too late. You know, right. I should have worked a little harder. I should have done this. That, but then it's too late. So you can always keep trying. But.
No, absolutely. So what about Paul Newman's posthumous memoir?
Yeah, that was really interesting. When I heard it was coming out, I was like, wait a second, he's dead.
yeah, did he write?
Yeah, this is going to be interesting. And what happened was, in 1986, he and a friend of his, Stuart Stern, who was a screenwriter, they decided they would record conversations with not only Paul Newman, but with people he knew, with family, with friends, colleagues. And he said the one caveat is everyone has to tell the truth. It has to be truthful. He said he wanted to set the record straight about himself. Okay. Well, I read the book, and let me say this about Paul Newman. I think he's one of the great actors of all time. Yeah. I really do. I actually just saw The Hustler for the first time a few weeks ago, which I'm ashamed to say was the first time. And I was just absolutely knocked out by it. Knocked out. I mean, what an amazing film and performance. And I'm very fond of The Color of Money, which was the sequel he did 25 years later.
Right.
So he was also a very difficult person. He did not like his fans. He would not give autographs.
What?
Yeah. And he ha- always had a reputation. Oh, Paul Newman is such a great guy because all the charitable work he does and all those. Yeah, he was a great philanthropist. But if you were to approach him on the street, he wouldn't give you the time of day. And reading this book, he addresses that also. He said he doesn't know where the ritual of giving autographs started, but he said, I wasn't around to vote on it. Mm-hmm. And he did not like fame. He did not like the fame part of it. Although there are things he says in the book where it's like, well, I think he does appreciate some of the fame. He just didn't appreciate people coming up to him, or he just had a lot of bad experiences, like in restaurants and things like that. And he said the thing that made him finally refuse to give autographs was he was, I believe he was at a restaurant and he was in the men's room at a urinal. I'll stop there and yeah. Probably figure out how that story. So my whole thing is, you know what? There are a lot of fans who don't know how to behave properly, and Right. Fine. Anytime I've encountered a celebrity, I've always tried to keep in mind, you know, don't disturb them if they're in a private moment or something like that. Yeah. Oh, and I had one bad experience meeting a big star. Yeah. I'll tell you in a second. But he didn't like the fame aspect in that respect. But he liked what fame was able to give him in terms of, you know, not just money, but other things. Mm. And, you know, especially he was politically active in the 60s. And as I was reading the book, which is a terrific read, if you're a Paul Newman fan, I would definitely suggest you get the book. But as I went on and on, I was having less respect for him the more I read. Mm-hmm. And he seemed to almost find that his good looks was a handicap. And it gets to the point where it's almost he's whining about how good looking he is.
Oh, it's so pretty.
Yeah. Poor me, I'm so pretty. Yeah. And I must say, if you wanted to set the record straight, he certainly did, because he was brutally honest for the most part. And when he met Joanne Woodward, he was already married and had children. And he carried on an affair with Joanne Woodward for years before he left his first wife and married her. And it was very hard on Paul Newman's children. And it was really hard on his first wife because she wanted to be an actress. And he goes off and, you know, right after becoming really successful, and marries a successful actress. And one of his daughters said, you know, it was so heartbreaking for, you know, them to see their father go off with another movie star. And Joanne Woodward comes off very poorly in the book. So I'm kind of surprised that, and he burned the tapes. He was not going to want this to be released, and he decided against it. He burned the tapes. But they found there were transcripts of all the conversations. So they worked with his family and got the whole book together. So it's very interesting. You know, my judgments, personal judgments aside, I'm not a moral authority on anyone's behavior, but maybe he wasn't whining so much about how handsome he was. But I would definitely recommend reading it. As for the celebrity who was not nice, I was on my lunch break once in Midtown, and I went to the Time Warner Center here in the city, and I saw Mickey Rooney and his wife. Mm-hmm. Mickey Rooney was quite old at this point, and as you can imagine, he was very recognizable. Yeah. And I went over to him and put my hand out and said something like, you know, one of my typical lines, oh, Mr. Rooney, I'm such a big fan of yours. And he lifted his hand away and then like walked off like he was very angry. And the wife was so embarrassed and she apologized. She said, I am so sorry. And it was almost like he was a child. She said to him, you get over here. And she said to me, what's your name? I said, my name is Brian. She said, you get over here. You shake Brian's hand. So he then comes over and he shakes my hand, but like begrudgingly, like a really like quick, abrupt, quick shake.
Yeah.
And I could see she was so mad. And she said, "I'm so sorry." I said, "That's okay." But it gave me a great story to tell when I got back to the office.
Yeah. Oh my gosh, that's horrible.
Yeah. And then, you know, it's funny because I really didn't know much about Mickey Rooney aside from the Judy Garland films and all that. So I looked online when I got back to the office and I found out he had a very bad reputation in Hollywood. Mm-hmm. That he was very kind of pompous, and you know, he's like, "I'm Mickey Rooney," and yeah,
right.
You know, one of those people, a real egomaniac. So, but the majority of the time, the smart ones know how to play the game, and they know, you know what, I'm better off just signing the autograph, taking the picture, and that's it. And some of the biggies, like Al Pacino, I've never met him, unfortunately. I hope I do one day.
Yeah.
He absolutely just loves when fans ask for autographs and posing for pictures. And there's some clips on YouTube of him exiting the stage door when he was on Broadway. Wow. And he jumps up on the car and waves to everybody and goes to each side and poses for pictures. And one woman kisses him, and he's the anti Paul Newman.
That's awesome.
He loves that. He really, really enjoys when the fans do that. And that's nice because they also have to put up with these obnoxious photographers who only want the autographs to sell online.
Yeah.
And they know that. And some of these photographers are incredibly obnoxious and rude. So, and they're not really fans. Most of the time they know where these people are going to be and they already have the photos there. Your average fan is not going to have an 8x10 of them, you know, unless they know exactly where they're going to be. Like if you're on Broadway, well, you have the playbill for them to sign. And a celebrity who I've also never met, but who's really smart about it is Liam Neeson. Because mm-hmm. he'll sign the autographs for the photographers and everything. And if it's a real person, he'll be nice to them and pose for the picture and all that. But he'll tell the photographers, he'll say, in his Liam Neeson voice, "If I see this online, I'm going to kill you. I can't do a Liam Neeson impression because I'm going to find you and I'm going to kill you." and then he says to them, "If you're going to sell this online, give the money to charity." He says, "Donate this to this charity or that." So, but you know what? He comes off looking like such a good guy doing that.
Yeah.
As opposed to if he just said, no, go away.
Right.
And so he plays the game. He knows how to play the game. Paul Newman didn't care to play the game, and he really didn't care what people thought. Right. And, you know, and I don't know that it was that big. People knew really the extent to which he was like that with fans.
Wow.
You know, and again, I don't think one idiot at a urinal should ruin it for everybody else.
that's crazy. That is out of line. That is out of line. Okay, so real quick, tell me about your upcoming trip for your 50th birthday to Las Vegas.
50? Oh my God!
Are we? I 50? Was just that's crazy. I'm close to 50 as well.
Oh my God! I was just 18. How did this happen?
I know.
Oh my God. Yeah. Well, since it is a landmark birthday, I'm going to one of my favorite places, which is Las Vegas, and going to try to have a very good time. I was last there in June. I had an amazing trip. I mean, just so much fun. To me, it's Disney World for adults. It's magical, and there are lights, and there's fountains, and just anything you can imagine is there. And it's just a great place. And to tell you how much I like Las Vegas, this will be my 20th trip there.
Whoa, I guess you do.
Yeah. Yeah, well, 20th trip in 25 years, yeah.
Wow. Well, I was going to ask if you'd been there, but yeah, 20 times, I guess you do like it.
Yeah, I do. I like it even more when I leave with their money. But as I've gotten older, I've when I was going there in my late 20s, I had some very good luck, and I also lost money. But I was really, this was a sign of youth, how irresponsible I was. And it paid off sometimes. It paid off very nicely sometimes. Yeah. The times it didn't, I didn't have as much fun. So the last few trips, I've been very restrained. I gamble, but I figure, okay, if I'm going to lose this, fine. And you have to go with the attitude, whatever you're going to bring, you're going to lose. And whatever you come back with, that's great. I came back with something.
Right.
And, you know, I had an insane trip once where I won an insane amount of money, and it's never going to happen again. So I try to, you know, say, okay, if I could just come home with anything, I'm fine. And, you know, also try not to drink until after 5 PM. I think that's helpful too. So, right. So I'm looking forward to going and hopefully having a good time and maybe winning some money, but definitely I know I'll be having some really nice dinners and nice time hopefully. And I think as someone who's now eligible to join AARP, I deserve it.
I know.
And I'm not joining, by the way. I'm being very defiant. I will not join them. I don't want any discounts, okay?
Oh, I want all the discounts I can get. I earned them.
Yeah. I'll wait until maybe when I'm 60, I'll take the discounts, right? No, I don't want the discount. I want them to ID me still. I miss being ID'd.
Yeah, they carded me for a long time, and now they don't do it anymore. I'm like, aren't you gonna card me? What? Come on.
Seriously, about 5 years ago, someone asked me for ID, and it was a very young person. Mm-hmm. And I was like, well, it's like, you're terrific.
I love you.
Yeah. How old do you think I am? Oh, you must be really old. You're 12, you know? Oh, okay. Yeah, great. Yeah, but I miss those days of, you know, having to show the guy, having to, you know, okay, here you go. Thank you.
Right. Because I was always that kid who looked a lot younger than she did.
Me too. Yeah, and I always looked younger. Yeah.
And that now I would go, I would get anything.
Yeah, now, yeah, I'm able to get anything. Yeah. It's amazing how it changes. I remember turning 21 and being very proud to need a fake ID.
Right.
You know, and now I'm turning 50 and I'm just glad I don't need a walker. So,
yeah, absolutely. But no, Brian, this has been so fun. And I'm so glad you got in touch with me.
Yeah, always a pleasure, Brooke.
So, and we got to do this more often, but let's make this a regular thing.
Absolutely. You just, look, you know, you can contact me anytime. Don't be a stranger.
Cool. And same with you. Same with you.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Find out what you're up to.
Appreciate it.
Cool. Well, you have a wonderful day, and I will let you know when this posts.
Okay, great. Thanks again, Brooke.
Thank you so much. Good to talk to you, Brian.
Likewise. Bye.
Bye.
Thank you so much to Brian Scott Mednick for chatting with me. If you want to see more of Brian, you can go to his website, brianscottmednick.com, which will be linked on the page. And I think we're going to make this a regular series on the podcast, so you'll definitely see him back here again. Thanks for listening. This is a Hotspur Media production, music by Corey Knoxville.